Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about BlackRock. Now, this is primarily going to be a story about corporate governance. Let's say that you are an asset manager. Somebody has given you money to invest in the stock market or the bond market or the real estate market, whatever it is, because they don't have the time or the skill set to do this themselves. You've now got potentially a large amount of money at your disposal, and you're buying into assets, and therefore you become one of the top holders in whatever company it is that you might be investing in. Now, of course, the managers of any business, you know, they're not ultimately the boss of that business. The shareholders are the boss of that business, although they are the management team, they're operating it. And they have to report back to their boss every so often. So whenever they get results out, what they do is they go around and they tour, and they go and visit the different asset managers and report back on how they've performed over the last year and what they've done for shareholders. So if you are one of these asset managers, and you're collating all these investments that you're administering on behalf of other people, and you're meeting this management team, that gives you a certain degree of influence over the people who are running these companies. The things that you focus on are going to be the things more or less that they focus on. So let's say, you know, you want to spend all that time talking about, say, environmental risk or political risk. You know, invariably those are the things that are going to be flagged up the concerns for the management team as well. And not least, of course, you get to vote on any proposals that the company puts forward, its shareholder votes and so on, which will include the appointment of managers and the people running that business. So it's possible for you as an asset manager to have quite considerable influence over the firms that you're running. Now, most investors are actually fairly passive investors. I used to be an asset manager. I used to, as well as venture capital, we did other asset management of listed companies as well. And this is what we do. We'd meet them every so often, but we wouldn't tend to get involved in steering the management team the way we wanted them to go, because, of course, if you don't like what the management is doing, it is far easier in most cases simply to sell that investment and go and invest with a management team that you do like, that you do feel you know, are positively responding in the way to market challenges that you feel is appropriate. Here's the issue with BlackRock. They're just way too large for that. They've got $10 trillion in assets to manage. Now, that's an extraordinary amount of money. Put it this way. If you were to add up all of the cash in the world, and I'm not talking about just US dollars here, I'm talking about every currency in the world. If you were to add up the total amount of physical cash, notes and coins in the entire world, that would come to $7 trillion. BlackRock has $10 trillion. So that gives you an idea of the scale of the company that BlackRock is. Another way of looking at it, if you were to take all 2,100 billionaires in the world. That comes up to, I think, about 9 trillion. Again, BlackRock has got more money than all the billionaires in the world added up. So you can't really do the passive thing at that sort of scale because, well, if you're not doing it, basically nobody is. So their solution was to systematize corporate governance. And they decided to go for a scorecard type approach, and thus was born ESG, environmental, social, and governance, that we've all heard so much about. Now, of course, once they've done that, it's created a very powerful management incentive manipulation tool. Now, even if this thing was designed with the very best of possible intentions, it is nevertheless something which is going to be very much of interest to everybody to get their hooks into in order to push their own favoured agendas. Now, you can tell from the way that it was created in the first place with the environmental and social bits on there. I mean, you definitely need the governance bit. That's important. The social bit, well, that kind of makes sense because, you know, that's the market that you're selling into. But it's really the environmental thing that has concerned people. But by putting this up, packaging it together, and using that as a scorecard by which you're going to either increase or decrease your investments in certain companies, and therefore either drive up or drive down the share price, this is effectively pushing this agenda at the highest level of corporate America and the rest of the world, as BlackRock operates in many places around the world now. So that's the issue that's got everybody upset about this company. And I do want to come back to that. But first of all, let's tell the story of BlackRock and its origins. Now, in order to do that, I'm going to need to tell you the story of effectively one man, Larry Fink. So, full name, Lawrence Douglas Fink. He was born back in 1952. You can look on Wikipedia if you want to learn more about his early life. But the cliff notes are he did a degree in political science from UCLA in 1974. He went on and did an MBA, and he started his career in Wall Street at a place called First Boston, still a big financial institution, and that is a New York-based investment bank. And what he did for them is he was one of the first mortgage-backed security traders. And he eventually went on to manage the firm's entire bond department. Now, he was a member of the management committee. He rose to being a managing director. He headed the mortgage and real estate products group. And he was very successful for a couple of reasons. Well, I suppose, first of all, he was quite talented at this stuff. But the things that perhaps marked him out was he was an early adopter of the computer, which sounds completely sort of hygiene level today, but back in 1970, hardly anyone used them. And he pushed them on his department very hard. And even the computers that you had available in 1970, they gave you an edge against the rest of the field. And the second was he was a pioneer in the mortgage-backed security space. We'll certainly be hearing a lot more about those as we go through this story. By understanding those things, you know, basically mortgage-backed securities is when you package up a lot of individual mortgages into a product. And, you know, we typically think about this from our side being perhaps people who have mortgages with the bank. You know, we take out a mortgage so that we can buy a home. But think about it from the other side, from the financial institution side. What a collection of mortgages is a bundle of asset-backed financial product that's going to be paying you out an income stream over a long period of time, potentially, well, decades. So that's very valuable to investment firms. So he was wildly successful for First Boston. In fact, he added $1 billion to their bottom line over the time that he worked there. And bear in mind that this is back in, this is back in the late 70s, early 80s. So $1 billion back then was really big money. And he was successful up until 1986, when he and his department, he lost $100 million in a single month. And what effectively led to that is because he made an incorrect prediction about the way interest rates were going to go. And he completely screwed up by not hedging his risk. Essentially, he assumed that something would never happen, and therefore he didn't need to make a risk adjustment or a balancing risk trade against the trades that he was making, and that cost him $100 million in a month. This is him describing it in his own words.
When you started having those types of successes, the firm gave you more capital. We were taking bigger and bigger risks without the attended risk technology to navigate that risk. And in the second quarter of 1986, we lost $100 million.
Now, following this, he wasn't fired, but he definitely became a bit of a black sheep at that point. Nobody really wanted to be seen with him. He was sort of kept out of the loop going forward. And this was his response.
I said to myself 30 days after we lost money in that quarter, even though we made 130 the first quarter and lost 100 of it in the second quarter, I said, I'm leaving. But it took me a year and a half. Because I never, ever thought I was going to leave, but it took me a year and a half to try to determine what I wanted to do next.
So after this, he's milling around, not knowing what to do with himself, when a big player from Wall Street, certainly a big player now, very much so these days, Steve Schwarzman comes along. Steve Schwarzman has a company called Blackstone, and he sees the potential in Fink. And he offers to back him starting a new business. So in 1988, under the corporate umbrella of the Blackstone Group, Fink co-founds BlackRock. And he became its director and CEO. Now, Blackstone today is one of the largest private equity companies in the world. Back then, it was on the rise, but it was, you know, still a major player. After Fink's disastrous experience where he lost all that money, Fink becomes all about risk management, how to protect your investments, how to protect your money. And he goes really big on stats and algorithms and uses these to make investment decisions and to hedge those decisions so that even if it turns against you, you know, basically you lose a little bit of money on options until you don't, until you need it. And other investment decisions, non-correlated assets, that kind of stuff. Fink is very successful, and he grows his little firm very rapidly. And what he wants to do is he wants to bring in new talent, because, of course, he can't do all of this himself. So he goes back to Steve Schwarzman, and he says, you know, give up some of your equity, because he wants to offer equity options to new guys coming in, very talented guys who might come in and help them grow this. So equity options are basically where you say to somebody who's going to join you, you know, we're going to pay you a salary, probably quite a good salary, but we're not going to pay it all in salary. What we do is we give you whatever, you know, 10,000 share options. These share options are today not worth anything, but if the share price of this company that we're all trying to push along together hits a certain level, then these shares will vest, these options will vest, and you will get these effectively free shares because they've been pushed up to a certain high enough level. But you need space on the share cap table to do that, and there wasn't any because Steve Schwarzman basically owned so much of it. So he wanted to go to Steve Schwarzman and say, give up a little bit of yours so that we could bring in new talent and we can grow the overall size of the pie. That did not sit with Schwarzman's mental makeup. He didn't want to do that. He basically wanted to hold on to all of it himself, so he refused. And that led to a rift between the two, between Fink and Schwarzman. So Fink wants to find a way to get out. And it rather helps at the time this is happening that Schwarzman is going through a divorce. So Schwarzman needs to get his hands on some cash. And Fink gets PNC Bank to invest in him. And they offer hundreds of millions to buy out the Steve Schwarzman stake. Now, you've got to bear in mind that this company was started only a few years earlier for $5 million. And now he's being offered hundreds of millions for half of it. So, you know, that's a pretty good return, and Schwarzman agrees to do this deal. Turns out to be the worst decision that Steve Schwarzman ever made, but, you know, he's still got hundreds of millions out of it, so he's not doing too badly. So BlackRock split from Blackstone in 1994. Fink retains his position as CEO of this. And at that point, he's running about $8 billion of fixed income products. That's actually kind of small by Wall Street investments, but as we will see, he starts to do quite well from there. Now, the big breakout event for him was when he came to the rescue of a company called GE, General Electric. General Electric was another firm that was growing extremely strongly in the 80s. It became a bit of a giant. And they've been doing lots of acquisitions. One of the things that they had acquired was a financial institution called Kidder Peabody. Now, it turned out that this was a bit of an FTX of its day. It was rotten to the core. There was lots of insider trading going on. There was lots of accountancy fraud. And when GE figured out what a complete mess that they had bought, they realized that they had to get out of this. This was not their skill set. This was a bad investment. It was not as they hoped it was going to be. So they go to somebody, doesn't matter who it is, but I mean, it was Payne Weber, who said, yeah, okay, we're going to buy this Peabody business off you. But what we don't want is that bit of it. And that bit was about a $10 billion CMO portfolio, collateralized mortgage obligations, very similar to mortgage-backed securities. And, you know, that stuff is very complicated. They don't want to touch it. GE certainly doesn't want to be left with that bit. So what they do is they go to Larry Fink. You know, Larry Fink basically invented this stuff. He was there at the emergence of it. He was one of the pioneers of financializing this stuff. So what they need him to do is to basically take this big package of mortgages, unpackage it, repackage it. It's financial engineering, essentially, what they're looking to get him to do. And that's his edge. That's what he does. He's a financial engineer who can tackle these sort of hard problems. And this becomes very important later.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
All over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.